Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. On our way to our conversation, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you, and you get money in the end. Go to www.mecu.com, or you can go to steinershow.org and click on their banner. All the information is there. Again, Baltimore's Credit Union, mecu.org. We're going to start our show off today. We have our guest host with us today. I'm really happy to have him back in the studio. It's been a while. He's been a very busy man. Dr. Lester Spence is back in the house. It's always good to see you.
It's good to see you too, man. It's good to be back.
It's good to have you back to help us pitch and help us talk about the books we're talking about this hour. We're joined by phone Dr. Alan Gilbert, who was here with us last time, a few months back, I should say. He is the Johns Evans Professor at the Joseph Korbel School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of the book, for which he was on the show last time, Black Patriots and Loyalists, Fighting for Emancipation in the War of Independence, and just got back from Palestine and Israel. We might talk a little bit about that as well. And Alan, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Mark. Good to be here.
How are you?
I'm very well.
You must be a little tired.
Well, I'm a little bit in shock at what I saw.
Well, we'll get to that, too. I mean, we want to talk about what happened in Palestine from your perspective. But that's really. But let's start off with the book.
Sure.
Let me start this way. I want to describe what the book did to me the first time I read it. I think I've said it to you when we were on the air before. And your book, I think, turns a lot of what we think about in terms of American history and the role of black folks in the revolution on its head. And let me just throw out a couple examples that really hit me, and then we can talk about them in some depth. One is just the battle that broke the back of the British and won the war under George Washington, Yorktown. Very few people know until your book that if it wasn't for the free black troops and native troops that fought from Rhode Island, they wouldn't have won that decisive battle, A. B, we don't know much about Dunmore and his proclamation. If the Brits have listened, there may never have been a United States of America to say to all slaves, come fight for Britain, fight for the crown, and you will be free. If that had happened, what would have happened? And also, the black guerrilla armies had fought throughout the war against the loyalists, against the patriots, because they wanted freedom. So their stories, I think they're important because they talk about a root, Alan Gilbert, of our history and us as a people, as Americans, that we don't know. And I think that it could change our perceptions of ourselves if we did understand them.
Yes. Part of the thing is that American history is written idealizing the founders. And the founders wanted democracy and, to some extent, the Bill of Rights for themselves. But they also held slaves. There were founders who opposed this vehemently. But people don't look from the point of view of the slaves. And in that respect, it's exactly parallel to Israel, which says that it's settled on a land without people, but the Palestinians were there. And there are now 7 million of them, 6,600 in exile and 400,000 displaced persons. And the national myths are the same. You look from above, not from below. So the points you made illustrate the fact that black people were fighting for their freedom, and many whites, particularly sailors who had been involved in the international uprising against slavery or seen it in the Caribbean, who had been pressed into service by the British, that is, captured and enslaved, basically, were sympathetic to the slaves who revolted, and they brought the message to London in 1760 and to America in 1764, where James Otis wrote the immortal words, "Every man has natural rights, black as well as white." And this was discussed in every tavern in the lead-up to the Revolution and is responsible for a large abolitionist movement on the American side, along with Christian insight into the dire sin, that slavery was a sin of crimson dye, as the preacher Samuel Hopkins put it. And this led to gradual emancipation in the northern states during and following the Revolution. So there's a whole other history of the Revolution which is completely buried. People barely know that there was slavery in the North until it was challenged in the American Revolution. And people do not know what Private Flohr, a German private fighting for the Americans, discovered walking around the field at Yorktown. He said, "Most of the corpses lying around the field on both sides were Mauren, Moors, Most of the corpses at Yorktown were Moors. So the whole history needs to be seen from the point of view of the black soldiers on both sides, the slaves who were fighting for freedom. If the American Revolution was about freedom, then it is part of the international uprising against slavery more than it is the first movement for independence.
And I think that for me, the importance of the work you're doing here, I really can't underestimate. I've been telling people about this book and giving it away and telling them to buy the book just because Black Patriots and Loyalists is just it is doing what you described. And what it means for us is, because we always look at history in America, and it's always growing up most history except the last maybe 10 years, some people have been fighting it in schools and in the last 40 years in different books. We see our history through the eyes of not just white America, but we see history through the eyes of those who are at the top, those who own property, those who own industry. And what this says to us is about there would have been, in some ways, no struggle for freedom without the struggle of black folks to end slavery. That's part of the subtext to me of your book.
Absolutely. And you could, to go along with that, I would just say many of the whites who made up revolutionary crowds, all of whom were poor, did not like slavery and fought for freedom, and by freedom they meant something which was deeper and more consistent than what many of the founding fathers did. There were people like John Lawrence, who was not well known, and he was killed at the end of the Revolution, but he was an assistant, an aide-de-camp to Washington, and he fought slavery with great verve and helped fight for the Continental Congress to pass a resolution recruiting and freeing 3,000 slaves in South Carolina and 2,000 slaves in Georgia. That was in 1779. And had that been done, the American Revolution would have conquered slavery in the South as well as in the North. But the state legislatures, the new state legislatures in South Carolina and Georgia, stalled this out. And Lawrence went back to South Carolina to fight, and he fought in the state legislature for this. And it came close. It was not the case that America had to be a slave society after the revolution. Every other independence revolution in the hemisphere, starting in Saint-Domingue, which became Haiti as a result of the slave uprising, and Venezuela, where Bolivar went to Republican Haiti when he was losing to Spain and got aid and then returned, the great liberator, and proclaimed gradual emancipation as part of independence. Every other revolution in the hemisphere freed the slaves in making independence. Only the United States had a civil war 80 years after. So the minute that you drop the lens of racism and you look at black and brown people to the South and you ask about the successor revolutions for independence, from that moment you realize that it didn't have to be this way in America. There didn't have to be continuing slavery and the power that it has in our politics to this moment when... Personally, I think that the only people beyond the 0.0001% who want to vote for Mitt Romney are powerfully moved by some degree of, hey, he's other. I mean, he's black.
So we're going to have to take a very brief break to talk about our station and come back to finish our conversation with Alan Gilbert, whose book is Black Patriots and Loyalists Fighting for Emancipation and the War for Independence. And we'll explore John Lawrence and what this man who could have been president of the United States, how that might have changed America, explore what Dunmore's proclamation meant, explore the role, the deep role that African Americans played in the liberation of America and fighting for their own liberation. But right now we have to come back and talk about WEA, so don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and I'm here with Dr. Lester Spence, who's my colleague and friend who comes in often to co-host and talk about issues of the day. He's, of course, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University, author of Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop Politics. And we're here with Dr. Alan Gilbert. Alan Gilbert is a Johns Evans Professor at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. As the author of Black Patriots and Loyalists Fighting for Emancipation in the War of Independence. Alan, let me just come back to where we left off. Because I want to – there are a couple of stories here to tell, I think, that that are really illustrative of that war. There's three of them I want to make sure we get to. One is who you left off with, John Lawrence, a man who was killed before the end of the war. And but as you describe him, a Southerner, abolitionist, really fought for the freedom of African Americans, and many people thought he would run for president. And I think about if he had been president of the United States of America after Washington, what America might have been.
Yes, it's a really good thought. John Lawrence was the son of a big slaveholder from South Carolina who had Christian scruples about slavery, Henry Lawrence, and was the second president of the Continental Congress. And they were Huguenots, who had Protestants who had been persecuted in France. And John went to school, studied in London and in Geneva. And in Geneva, he learned, it was 15 years after Rousseau had written The Social Contract and the Discourse Against Inequality, and he learned deeply and in a principled way that you can't have equal freedom if you have slavery, and that the masters will, in fact, become cruel, terrible despots and do harm among themselves. And so he was really, he was the one person in the American Revolution who actually understood Rousseau deeply. There are many people against slavery, but he understood this in a very profound way. And he was also a very brave man, and he was he fought in all the battles in the American Revolution and was wounded several times and captured by the British, and Washington exchanged one of the leading prisoners he captured for him, and led black troops into battle at Yorktown. He and Alexander Hamilton led black troops into battle at Yorktown. And they joked about James Monroe, who later became president. Hamilton wrote that he's a Don Quixote-ish sort of fellow like yourself and would be glad to get banged about the head in order to do something honorable. And, you know, would that it had been true. But anyway, you know, it really greatly depends what happened. Lawrence had profound convictions against slavery and would have fought very hard all his life about this. And whether he could have been president if the movement had not succeeded is an interesting question. But really, the Americans relied on black troops. The 1st Rhode Island Regiment fought for 5 years, and they were the most seasoned fighters, the best in maneuvers, said Baron von Clausen, who was the advisor to Washington, who reviewed them before Yorktown. There were a quarter of the troops at Yorktown and the main fighters at Yorktown. Took the two crucial British strongholds. And most Americans who joined, whites, joined the militias, so they were out after 10 months. So that's the reason that blacks were the most effective fighters. And Lawrence was well aware of this and wanted to lead black troops. I mean, he did then, but I mean, he wanted to recruit and lead them. And this was the answer to, you mentioned Dunmore. Governor Dunmore, starting in 1772, he was the royal governor of Virginia, said, "Oh, you proud rebels, if you revolt, I will recruit every slave and indentured servant, who were mostly white, who will come to the British side, and I will sow destruction wherever I can reach, and I will raze your mansions to the ground." He said that in 1772, and he said it continuously after that. And in November 1775, he issued his famous proclamation, which called blacks and indentured servants to the British side. And by then, every black in the South had become, as one patriot slave owner, a woman, put it, he said, "I suspect," she says to the slave, "you are torrified like most of your color." And so this became the heart of the British fighting forces in America and did all the work around the camps, and every division of British forces was followed by 4,000 or so blacks who had freed themselves and, in order to get food, would raise any mansion that they ran across. And so they were a very dangerous force who was part of what the British had supporting them. And the British kept recruiting new troops from this. And they launched some guerrilla moves from this in New Jersey, as you say, New York and New Jersey, Captain Tighe, and in South Carolina. And the Americans, to keep up, had to recruit blacks to fight. And Washington moved from being a slave owner who disdained to have blacks fight for him to realize that the Revolution could not survive and would not survive without blacks being recruited. And he actually became completely, he disbelieved in slavery after this.
You know,
let's just bounce. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
You know, your story sounds a lot. It reads a lot like Black Reconstruction in America. W.B. Du Bois's book, and it's.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's interesting that it was written like some more than 100 years later. I was wondering if you could.
I probe Du Bois.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. I was wondering if you could answer just a couple questions. One is you mentioned earlier that whites. That poor whites had a different conception of freedom that was richer. And I'd imagine blacks had that same conception of freedom. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. In America, many blacks who fought thought that they were fighting for freedom. And it came out even sharper on the British side. That is, they wanted to fight for the freedom of everybody. And they figured that freedom is not going to last here in a revolution for freedom. And on the British side, there's in particular a black sergeant named Murphy Steele, and he was in the Black Pioneers in South Carolina. And he had a vision, and people had visions then, easily. And he wrote it out. He got the officer to Sir Henry Clinton, who was the commander of the British forces, to write it down. So there's this record of it. He said a few days ago, I was in the barracks, and a voice came to me and said, you got to tell General Cornwallis and General Clinton to tell Washington he's got to surrender. And then it came to me in Queen Street, and it said to me again, you got to tell them they'll surrender, or they will recruit all the black men in America to fight, because the British diverted a lot of their forces into doing all the work around the camp rather than being soldiers. And he understood that these were soldiers for freedom and for the freedom of all on the British side, that is, the freedom of the slaves. So what happened was that even though they were fighting within an empire, they were fighting for freedom too. So their point of view was the deeper point of view. And, you know, they went on to be free in Canada, and then they didn't get land, and they went to Sierra Leone and founded a radical democracy, which is the first great democratic experiment, or along with American towns and Athens, except it's better than Athens because they didn't have slaves. Right? So, like the Paris Commune, so it's not too bad.
So the second...
Wait, we hit the second question, okay. We come back. We got to take a brief break to talk about your public radio station, WEA, and then let Lester Spence have his second question and many more. For Albert Gilbert, author of the book Black Patriots and Loyalists, Fighting for Emancipation in the War of Independence, a book that will change your mind in thinking about the origins of democracy, the origins of fighting for democracy, the origins of democratic society. It's a profound book. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. On our way back to our conversation, I want to remind you that our partner for the last 4 years in this program, our print partner, has been Urbanite Magazine. And you know, it folded, which is a shame for our community because it was an amazing journal that brought together people from a cross-section of Baltimore, the metropolitan area, to talk together, to work together, to read together, to think together. It'll be sorely missed, but its website is still up and running and may be so till the end of the year, we hope. So you can still go and check out what they're doing and some incredible work at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. We're going to miss our presence in our community, but they'll always be our sister organization. We are here. Dr. Lester Spence is joining me tonight as a co-host, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University. His book, Stare in the Darkness, The Limits of Hip-Hop Politics, Did I do that wrong again?
Yeah, you did it wrong again.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, you did.
What did I say?
The limit of hip hop and politics, or hip hop politics. That's not it.
Sorry.
That's all right.
It's close though.
Yeah. Hey, you asked me.
I did.
Know, I try to be a truth teller.
You are a truth teller, and you're my brother and friend. So thank you. Yeah. Here we go. So, if it's not on my sheet, man, I can't remember it. It wasn't written on my sheet. I'll kill people later. But 410-319-88. No, I can. No, I'm introducing my guest, Alan Gilbert. John Evans, professor at the Joseph Corbel School.
Senior moment, man.
Of International Studies at the University of Denver. We're talking about his book, Black Patriots and Loyalists Fighting for Emancipation in the War of Independence. And in a few minutes, we'll talk a little bit about his trip to Palestine as well. But you had a second question, Lester.
Yeah, so the second question. So, again, Du Bois makes the same arguments about the Civil War, right, where black people are active subjects, and they're actually – they bring about the revolution. They actually bring about the revolution, and they change the attitudes and opinions of a number of really important elites in the Civil War. What I'm wondering is that why do you think there's such a gap between this book and yours, to the extent that you're one of the first people to really cover this in depth?
Look, the racism in the United States is so thick you can cut it with a knife. And it is to this moment, even though American democracy elected Barack Obama president and may, after all, reelect him. Both things are true. We have 2.3 million people in prison, better than half of whom are black, a lot of whom are for non-violent, having some marijuana, and so on and so forth. And this is 25% of the world's prisoners. We're destroying a generation of black and Chicano young men and many poor whites. And this needs to be changed. So one of the reasons I wrote the book was to give people the idea that there are people like Murphy Steele who stood up and said very significant things once upon a time, and there are people like W.E.B. Du Bois who stood up and said very significant things. And the truth is that each of us in our own way can do something about this. And despair is the weapon of empire, and we need to fight it.
So, Alan, I think that that's true, and I think, and you're, that kind of political analysis and thoughts all through the book. I mean, again, you know, I think most of us never heard of Murphy Steele before this. We knew about the nation that was founded on the backs of by Britain, as Liberia was founded by America. But the fact about this great democratic experiment was really not known. We don't talk about Sierra Leone.
Yeah, who knew from Sierra Leone? I didn't know from Sierra Leone about that history until I began looking into this. And I found Murphy Steele actually in documents. It was put in what was called the Gold Seal document at the Clinton Library, which is an archive at the University of Michigan, which has a lot of documents from the Loyalists. And, you know, very few people had found it, and later on, Simon Schama found it and reprinted it in his book, Rough Crossings, which is in some ways a very good book. And he just used it as a way of being snide about Cornwallis. He didn't take in the significance of here was one of the black voices from the Revolution saying something of enormous strategic power, which if Clinton had honored, either the American Revolution would have sunk like a stone because the British were the ones who were really fighting for freedom. I mean, who was really oppressed during the American Revolution? Slaves. The most oppressed. You know, more than a threepence tax on tea, your whole life is a slave, subject to sexual and physical abuse, intimidation, and killing. And so to find Murphy Steele was like a gift. And to give, you know, to have his words in the book and to comment on them is really, for someone writing history, a matter of honor. And just let me say one more thing.
Please do.
About WEAA. You know, I've had the best conversations with you about this book, and it's really great to talk with Lester. And these are matters of truth-telling. And Citizens United has made the American media, the mainstream commercial corporate media, even more dedicated to lies than they have been before. And if you want to hear about things like what people are doing, like Michelle Alexander against the prison industrial complex, or what people are doing to say, you know, Palestinians have human rights too, or what people are doing to say, you know, it'd be bad if we bombed Iran. Iran hasn't invaded anybody else in the Middle East. Guys who run it may be nuts, but the fact is it hasn't invaded anybody else in the Middle East, and both Israel and the United States have aggressed against plenty of people in the Middle East. So one of the things about it is, if you want the truth, probably WEAA is where it's at. And that's what Big Bird means here.
I heard that.
Even though I'm not going to a fundraising break quite yet, listen to what Alan Gruber said. And while we're talking to Alan about his book, call 410-319-8888 and make your pledge. And read the book and enjoy this history, 410-319-8888. But back to our conversation. And after this next break, when we come back, let me do it now. When we come back from the break, I want to go back to kind of some of the things in this book that came out that really struck me. You just got back from Palestine. We have like 2 minutes left before we have to go to break. Talk a bit about this, obviously, because you keep interjecting it into the conversation. This obviously really had a profound effect on you, this journey you just took.
Yes. It will be many months before I absorb this fully. Jews suffered the Holocaust. And the mania of Jews, but it's based in truth, is it could happen again. It could happen here. And there's a wonderful guy, a Palestinian Christian named Sammy Awad, who went to Auschwitz. And he listened to Israeli guides telling children, this could happen again, this could happen again, and understands deeply in the kind of nonviolence that he wants to further, to free everyone in Palestine and Israel, that there's a tremendous issue with Jews. And I would say part of the issue with the Israeli militarism and despising of international law is linked to this experience, this feeling of not being safe. So there's just a survey in Israel, and 58% of Israelis say apartheid is where it's at. Israel is an apartheid state, and it's where it's at. And if we seize the West Bank, Palestinians shouldn't be allowed to vote. I have just been in the Palestinian villages, and all I will say is the people are wonderful. They are hospitable and kind in a way, particularly the children, in a way that one rarely sees, and really worth taking in. And often children there are shot or they're locked up, they're taken in the military courts. A settler's child who gets in a fight goes to civilian court within 24 hours. A Palestinian child goes to the military court, is held for 8 days without a trial, often beaten, and then held a much longer time.
I'm sure we have to take a quick break and come right back to finish our conversation with you. We need to come back, talk about the station, then come right back to you. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and I'm here with Dr. Lester Spence. I do know the name of his book, no matter what he thinks. It's called Staring in the
Dark. You asked.
They didn't put it on my sheet, man. I can't get the name just right.
Got it.
I know. I read the book twice now.
Yeah, I know.
Staring in the Darkness.
Once more than I did.
Shoot. The Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics. Really incredible work. But we're talking about another incredible work, Black Patriots and Loyalists, Fighting for Emancipation in the War of Independence by Alan Gilbert. And Alan, we don't have a lot of time left, so what I'd like you to do, if you don't mind, is kind of make this connection for us, for you, as you're working this through in your own head, this connection between what you experienced when you went to the Middle East and what you experienced in creating and learning about this book as you were writing it, about the American Revolution and the power of the African-American world in that revolution.
It's really a startling parallel. The slogan of the Zionist movement was a land, a people without land, or land without people. And Jews had the Holocaust committed against them, and the treatment of Jews in Europe is unspeakable. And Jews had a long tradition of equality and democracy. And there was an attempt to form a Jewish equality and democracy, featured in the kibbutzim, the farming collectives, and the Histadrut, which was the union movement, but it excluded Arabs. And there were people on the land. And in the same way, if you look at the American Revolution, you can look at it from the point of view of sailors, black and white, slave and free. Many blacks, or some blacks, were free. And they were supporters of the anti-slavery movement that was emerging in the Caribbean. And they brought those ideas to London and to the United States 15 years before the American Revolution started.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the talk of all of the working class taverns. So this was, these were vital ideas in the American Revolution. Or you can take the official documents of the American Revolution. They don't even give you Tom Paine's wonderful writings against slavery. 1775 in Philadelphia. This is a very powerful theme of the American Revolution that doesn't bubble up. And if you look from the point of view of the Palestinians, I was just in staying over with Palestinian families in a number of villages, and one of them in the occupied territories is Nabi Saleh, and the wall is built along there, and through their olive groves, and olive trees are sacred in the Mediterranean, and particularly the Palestinians. And the settlers tear them down and burn them, and I can't speak of the crime that is. And the people of Nabi Saleh have demonstrated nonviolently against the wall, and they're now committed to nonviolence. There are some kids who are angry, and they occasionally throw rocks at tanks.
Right.
This is David and Goliath.
So I don't,
I think it's a mistake that they do that, and so does Sami Awad. But I understand it. I would just say it's not much of anything, and most of the rocks they throw are not like the tear gas canisters that come and hit them. So there was a fellow in the village.
Al, we only have like about a minute and a half left, so I'm just...
Yeah, named Mustafa Tamimi. And he demonstrated he was hit by a tear gas canister. They exploded his face, blood all over his body. The Jewish soldiers took him to the hospital where he died. And this little girl who played with him, Jana, who was seven, walked up to the Israeli troops. There's a film of it on the air on YouTube. If you Google Bilal Tamimi, you will find it. And she walks up to them and says, "Why did you kill Mustafa? He was my best friend.
Oh, wow.
I loved him." And the soldiers turn away, and some of them laugh nervously. And she says, "Why are you laughing?" And the guy who's filming it, his camera has been smashed. He's been beaten a number of times. Bilal, he gets out there and films it. And then she says, she sings a song which includes the phrase, "Who is right and who is wrong?" And she points at them.
Alan,
every aspect of Palestinian society illustrates this. It is a form of slavery, and it ought to be stopped. And everybody's human rights ought to be emphasized.
Alan Gilbert, it's always an honor and pleasure to talk with you. I can't wait for us to talk more about your trip to the Middle East. And his book, Black Patriots and Loyalists, Fighting for the Emancipation of the War for Independence. Alan, thank you so much, brother. Good to talk to you, and we'll be talking very soon again.
Thank you very much.
Take
care. Good to talk to both of you. Take care.
Peace.
A very, very brief break. We're going to come back and finish talking about WEA and why you need to call 410-319-8888. Stay with us.